Welcome back to the Prepared Mindset Podcast, everyone. I'm your host, Austin, and another week, another discussion, and hopefully the weather is heading upward for you guys. You're able to get out to the range, do some training, maybe start attending some courses as it becomes, more feasible. Here in Michigan right now, unfortunately, I think our weather just doesn't know what it's doing. So it makes things very complicated and difficult when like last weekend, we were at 70 degrees on Sunday, and then by Tuesday, we were at a high of 29. It might be a record low. It might have been a record low, I think, for St. Patrick's Day when I was sitting down recording with Mark Smith in our last discussion, which if you guys haven't checked that out, definitely go back and check it out. Great discussion. Really, really enjoyed that. And honestly, go ahead and feel free to look through all of the catalog of episodes as we are continuing to climb towards, I think it's 400. I think we're on the other side of 350 now for sure. And we're getting week at a time, closer to 400 episodes, which is really, really cool. And if you guys have been enjoying this, please feel free to go ahead and hit the subscribe button on whatever platform you're listening on. Drop us a comment and maybe check out some of our other platforms. Prepared Mindset is a learning experience that is unique in that it's me learning. Really, I am a self-admitted, idiot in a manner of speaking, right? And I want to make sure that I bring you guys along for this journey. I don't want to be sitting here like so many other quote unquote industry experts, right? Telling you the right way to do everything. I'm here learning and figuring this out for myself. And the goal is to just bring you guys along with me. And it's been pretty awesome so far. We're definitely feeling the love on the YouTube channel. We're dropping videos every day over there. Full length videos on the weekends and then just daily shorts, stuff like that. You guys know the algorithm, you know what it is. Like anybody who's trying to get any kind of traction in this community or in this industry, right? You know the struggle is real and you have to be posting on a regular basis to get attention. Sometimes people are posting multiple times a day if you are a large established presence with a dedicated social media person who gets compensated financially for their time. I don't. So you guys, I don't, it's every couple days for me, and what I can put out is what I can put out. So but speaking of the podcast, we are a sponsored podcast, which is really cool, and we're very, very fortunate here to be a sponsored podcast and work with partners that make this all possible week to week, so that I can continue to sit down with my guests and have these discussions, bring them to you guys, share the knowledge, share the information, provide my color commentary, if you will, my insight to everything that we're talking about. So with that, I do want to make sure that I take just a moment here and thank our presenting sponsor of the podcast, and that is Custom Night Vision, you guys. They are located down in Houston, Texas, and they are a bunch of, there's three of them really, a bunch of really, really good guys doing some really great work, bringing night vision as a capability and as a tool to all of us. Their website is customnightvision.com, and I implore you guys, go check out the website and see everything, and I do mean everything they have to offer. It's not just night vision. They have bipods from Fatboy, right? Or tripods, rather, from Fatboy. They have helmets from Team Wendy, and I was just talking about this with a buddy who's looking to get into his very first helmet. They have the whole line from Team Wendy there with the discount code provided in the item description. I don't know if you guys are going to find better pricing anywhere on the Team Wendy helmets, whether it's the bump helmets, the carbon bump, or any of their ballistic models. They're all available, again, at customnightvision.com. And once you have the helmet, next steps, hey, maybe you want to get the ear pro first, because hey, before I get night vision, I want to go shoot. They do carry contacts on the website. That was a new addition late in the 2025 calendar year. They do carry those, they do stock them, and you can add them on to your helmet, so you are good to go. And then of course, obviously, they carry night vision, right? It's customnightvision.com after all. So whether you're looking for a nice dual tube setup like some RNVGs, because you just want something durable that you can run over with a truck or drop out of a plane, or you want something, a little bit nicer, right? So maybe something lightweight, something low drag, right? Like, let's look at the different options from Nocturne Industries, because Custom carries all of those, right? So whether that's the Katana, the new Raptor that's coming out, they will have that, right? The UH-1 that's just been released from my friends over at Lowlight Innovations, they have those available. Or if you're looking into single tube options because you have a limited budget, that's okay. Things like the PVS-14, the PVS-14R, the Tonto, all kinds of good stuff. The Talent from Nocturne Industries that just came out within the last several months here. All of that and more is available at CustomNightVision.com. Let them know that Austin from Prepared Mindset sent you guys over. They're going to take absolutely fantastic care of you. So thank you very much to the whole team at Custom Night Vision. That's Ben, that's Trevor, that's Kevin for all their work, honestly, but certainly the support of what I do here every week with the podcast, bringing this discussion to you all. And we get to, like I said, go down that road together, take that journey together and learn. And speaking of discussions, this week I am sitting down once again with John Kettman. John was on a couple weeks ago. I'm not even going to try and quote how many weeks ago, because for me, I've said this before, my perception of like time and space and reality, man, it is so skewed when I look back at podcast guests. It's very, very difficult for me to track. Usually I'll say, oh yeah, I remember that guy. They were on here, you know, a month ago or several months ago, and it was like 3 years, something goofy, you know. But we've been doing this coming up on 6 years, believe it or not, launched during the pandemic. And over 6 years' time, some of that stuff does start to get a little bit blurry and does start to kind of lose a little bit of the definition in the old memory banks. So really, really cool to say that out loud, honestly. 6 years. It's crazy. Absolutely crazy. And really, really appreciate all of your guys' support. Again, if you're listening to this, please hit pause, go hit the subscribe button and share with a friend as well, because as we grow, we can do more. We can bring on better guests, right? And have better conversations on things you guys all want to hear about. But like I said, we have a fantastic guest this week. John Kettman, he is returning for his second appearance on the podcast in, I'm going to say two months. I don't know if that's realistic. I think it was, because I know there was snow on the ground, and I think it was maybe just after SHOT Show, I'm thinking. And yes, I think that's correct, because I remember having already talked to John, and then I was sending him photos and tagging him and stuff on my Instagram stories when I went to the Detroit Autorama at, I think it's Huntington Place now, I think, or Huntington Center. It used to be Cobo Hall. It'll always be Cobo Hall to me. One of my favorite events of the year, right? Classic cars of all different genres and eras, resto mods and true restoration projects and things like that. And John and I touched on it briefly the first time he was on. He has a Chevelle. I believe it's an SS. And while I'm not a Chevy guy, I do really like the Chevelle. It is one of my favorite classic muscle cars. So certainly found some really, really cool photos and tagged him in those and sent him on over when I was at the Autorama. So we are not going to be spending the discussion today talking, at least not too much, I don't think, about cars. But we are going to be getting into some, I think, new space with some concepts that John shared with me. Actually, I believe it was after we finished recording the last time he was on. Some concepts he borrowed from another gentleman. I believe it was Craig Douglas, and we'll clear that up once we get into our conversation with John. But the concepts of applied violence and physical violence, and this is something we've not really talked about here, but I think realistically something that we need to, given the realities of so much what we talk about here, right? We talk about shooting and training, and we talk about fighting and what that all entails. I think that this is probably, I mean, in my estimations, right, in my words, I'll say a long overdue topic that we need to tackle. So should be a really, really good one. Looking forward to diving into this with John. So with that, let's go ahead and get to it. John, welcome back, man. How are you?
Good. Good to be back here.
Yeah. Hopefully this time, I think we messaged a little bit yesterday. No ice storms or power outages looming from, you know, freak weather issues. I think it was a couple months ago, right? It was like January, I think, when we sat down.
Yeah, that's when we had a terrible ice storm down here. But now this past week's been a real tease of summer here in Tennessee. So no expected any power outages this time.
So, yeah, I mean, what is it? I mean, we're like in the 30s up here, low 40s, high 30s. What are you guys getting? Probably 60s and 70s, I'm assuming.
Oh, yeah. And this past weekend, we just hosted an event out at Cedar Creek, and it was in the 80s during the day and down to the 60s at night. Perfect temperatures.
Damn it. I'm so ready for it. You know, like last week we were, you know, in the 70s, and then 2 days later for St. Patrick's Day, it was 29 as a high. So it was miserable and cold and shitty. And we've kind of just been fluctuating back and forth. It makes, you know, range trips and stuff hard to plan. 'Cause if it's under 30, even I'm not going to go out there and waste time and ammo on that, especially with ammo going up, right? So I am definitely jealous of what you guys get down there in Tennessee. I'm sure it's probably a lot nicer for a lot longer during the year than what we get up here in Michigan. But
Oh, by far. I'm out in a short sleeve shirt most of the year. Can't
yeah,
complain.
I am not. I am not. We had talked a little bit the last time we sat down, and as we're talking through this, I think I probably in our intro just a moment ago misquoted the gentleman. I had said Craig Douglas, but I think you said it was Tony Blauer. We were just chatting before we hit record. This concept of like, and you'd have to explain this to me because I think I get it, but I don't know if I get it. Like applied violence and physical violence. What is that? And like, can you just walk me through what that is?
Yeah, so the applied violence side of things is how you take whatever tools and things at your disposal and actually action them onto whatever that threat is in different capacities, right? So figuring out what essentially is your stoplight of red, yellow, and green of react to some type of situation or threat, and what can you do about it at that time? And what tools do you have with you? And what can you do with those tools to redirect whatever that threat is doing or incapacitate them all the way. So it kind of comes down to really figuring out of what your actual capabilities are and your mindset as well. Tony Blauer is the guy I like to reference with the no fear, KNOW fear. And his big thing is pushing the mindset and understanding of what does it take to get you to flip that switch internally to be able to become a protector or an asset versus a liability of that fight or flight response whenever the threat or whatever situation's popping up, that how do you actually re react to that and apply that violence to change whatever that scenario is going on? Whether it's from a concealed carry aspect of it or in war or from a law enforcement or home defense situation of understanding, hey, there is a person that is intending to harm you at all costs, and then understanding what you can actually do about that in that time and space and frame that situation to where you understand I need to action now, or I need to decide something that's going to change this behavior before it escalates or goes to the next level of whatever's going on.
Well, and I think it's something that a lot of people assume they have the capacity and understanding for. You know, a lot of people that's ultimately what I think a lot of training is, right? Is in the event that you have to apply these skills, you'll be ready to do it physically, mentally, in any circumstances. Like, and thinking about it in a vacuum, I think a lot of people probably could be, but it's never that clean. And like I've had people tell me this before, that folks like us that carry firearms, there's some small part of you somewhere in the back of your mind that wants to shoot somebody. I'm like, I really don't know that that's true, man. Like I understand why you would feel that way, but I know that'd be the worst day of my life. Are you kidding me? Like that? What? No. I just it's a conscious choice to not be a victim, but at the same time, like. I don't think any, well, I'm not gonna say anybody, but most people, right, that pursue these activities, right, don't want to have to do those things. It's just something that you prepare for and then hope that when you call upon that skill set, it's there for you, at least from, I would say, a prepared civilian standpoint. Military and law enforcement obviously being a little bit different, but maybe not so much. I don't know.
Yeah, and I can speak from the military side of things too, of not having gotten a lot of guidance on that topic other than what drill sergeants or cadre from different schools have really just thrown out of one or two phrases here or there that really kind of frame that situation. And it's what are you prepared to do and what can you do with the tools that you have really? So going to one of the military courses I was in, I had an instructor that said, hey, if you're going to start shooting that gun, you better put all of those bullets into that person and turn them into a ball of flesh that is unrecognizable. Basically, cut their heads off with lead. Like, oh, okay, that is a clear depiction of what to do in this situation.
Yeah.
However, hearing that from someone that has been deployed multiple times and had to be in these situations, it really clicks of, okay, that's what the next step is. This is what the training's going towards. Versus, I see a lot of shooters that come out and get into competitions or into other sporting styles of shooting, don't ever get that same statement or usually have that same mindset, because that isn't the end goal or end state for them, is to have to use it in a defensive situation. A lot of them are out there to compete and have fun, which I absolutely encourage. Shooting guns is a ton of fun, and there's so many competitions to enjoy. But when you come to the actual applying violence with the tools, then it turns into a whole nother mindset of shifting the mental gear of, I need to use this to the maximum extent of its capability, versus, oh, only one or two shots per target, got to get two in the A zone or one on steel. Well, is that the right programming for shooting? Is that the right script that you need to have in your head to only send two rounds into an A zone onto a threat if it was presented, versus just a competition style shooting? So the bigger thing that a lot of matches have been adding is different round counts to get people to start understanding, hey, you need to be able to have multiple follow-up shots effectively on targets versus just the standard two, because we're trying to save ammo. And that's been a big thing of the ready up drills over the years of, all right, give me your best two. Well, that's usually due to ammo consumption constraints. When you start looking at units that have a significant amount of ammo or unlimited ammo in certain cases, they're shooting a lot more rounds into each paper target inside the shoot houses versus just one or two into specific zones. So understanding what that round will do onto a human and into flesh versus what it does on paper or steel targets kind of frames things a little bit different too, because it comes down to, are you using the right tool for the job at that point as well?
Yeah, and I think that's, I mean, do you think that that's where people get the very like this that ingrained feeling of, competition shooting and quote unquote tactical shooting, right, are different? And they're and it, like I get what people are trying to say with that, but I don't agree with the statement, right? Like shooting is shooting and good shooting is good, bad shooting is not good. But I understand. I think at the heart of the issue is people are trying to say that I think more to what you're talking about, right? The way that you apply the skill is definitely different to all the things you just said. Hey, one or two rounds to center mass is not going to necessarily always stop a grown man, let alone I'm thinking like domestic law enforcement or even, internationally, right? People that are under the influence of other substances and whatnot, right? They don't react to 2 9-millimeter rounds to the chest the same as you would imagine, right, based off of a lot of that training and stuff. And I think that's where people get really bent up and like wrapped around the axle, is that they want to make it two different things to try and communicate that point, and they just do it really, I think, really poorly.
Right. I definitely agree with that. And on the tactical shooter side, it's a lot of bravado. It's a lot of, hey, we're out here and we got picked to be in this role, that this is our job, is to use these firearms and apply the violence against the intended enemy, versus you guys are having fun and making up some games where you got to count your shots at certain times, which, don't get me wrong, I am a very competitive shooter and like the sports all day. But I see that significantly in the law enforcement and mil side of guys coming out to the range and having this thought in their head that they're the tough, angry guy that's ready to rip someone's head off, but they can't shoot a bill drill into the A zone in under 4 seconds. So they may have a different mindset. They usually have a different mindset of, I'm going to be aggressive with whatever is around me versus I'm the best with this tool. And that's a bigger divide I've noticed over the years of watching people that don't take the same, I guess, time to learn the shooting skills and just assume that their aggressive nature in general is enough to use whatever minimum skills or qualifications they have. Luckily, it's shifting though. There's a lot more mil and law enforcement guys out here getting after the competitions and then going back to their SWAT team or SF team and going into the shoot house and applying those skills that they learned from the matches, but also adding that secondary effect of, hey, we're in here. If my gun does run dry, what is the other option? I can use this as a big metal spear at the end of the day when I'm close in proximity to somebody if I had to and am tangled up and unable to draw my sidearm or a knife. But that's still one of those things that you have to be tested in some type of force on force scenario to really understand, will you go through that threshold when there are rounds coming your direction or towards your buddy? That's a big thing that is a mental shift for a lot of people the first time that they start seeing actual violence or get into a firefight or whatever have you type of violent situation, whether they freeze and try and process it, or they can actually react and apply the skills that they already have that they've trained to. A common saying in the military is you fall to your lowest level of training. Well, raise the bar for yourself. Make that lowest level something that's going to be an asset to yourself and those around you, is what I'm always trying to push out at the end of any class that I put on. So understand what your capability inside a gas station. If you had to take a shot at someone 25 yards away across the aisles, what does that actually look like? And turn that into part of your training program to where is it one or two shots into the guy at the cash register from 25 yards away? Or is that something you can't physically do with your concealed carry weapon that you choose because it's nice and small? Well, how effective and accurate can you be with that same thing? Might be time to look for a back door at that point.
Yeah, I mean, and that's all stuff that like when you put it together and it compounds upon itself, that I think makes the discussion on self-defense, concealed carry, prepared civilians, whatever, like all of those things, it makes it more complicated than I think a lot of people assume. You know, it's just, oh, it's just you carry a gun, and if you see something bad, you do something about it. And it's, yeah, you can, I mean, as with all things, right? If you distill it too much, you lose, you know, a lot of the essence of what we're talking about. And all those things, right? And that, this is part of the reason why when I see guys, or they just ask me about it, I have a couple of friends who've switched over to carrying like revolvers, small 38, you know, five shot, snub nose, whatever. Like, oh yeah, you know, I can fit in my pocket. I don't need a holster because the trigger's so damn heavy. There's no way anything's gonna happen. I'm like, I wouldn't know, but I'll take your word for it. And my follow on to that is always, well, how do you feel about that at like 20, like you said, 25 yards, if you had to actually do that, you know? And well, you know, I don't really shoot a lot. I mean, oh, I'm gonna be so close. It doesn't. And you start seeing people try to like, they start to back themselves into these like prefabricated scenarios in their mind where it justifies. And to me, it does two things. One, it shows the lack of training that they have and lack of understanding, but I think it shows that they imagine that they will be under certain circumstances when they have to be called upon to do these things, and they can perform extremely well under those specific and unique circumstances and not anything else. And it's a very weird thing because we just like we subconsciously convince ourselves that that's the way it's going to happen.
Right. It's too easy to get stuck into a vacuum of, all right, I'm good at this one thing in this situation. But as soon as you start pulling the rug out from under it, hey, does that still hold up? Is your training undeniable? Is it going to work under different circumstances, different lighting conditions, different times of year, and crowds of people too? So that's a big thing with a lot of the training and competitions that we put on out here, is the stress inoculation side of things. To really try and get people as amped up and focused and distracted of what's going on to where it really overwhelms the person to see how much stress they can push themselves through physically and cognitively to make the right decision and apply the fundamentals at speed. So this past weekend, we just hosted our third annual Midnight Madness night running game.
Yeah, I was gonna
It's
ask you about that. I saw the post online. It looked pretty fucking fun, honestly. Like a lot of shit out there.
Yeah, it's the most dynamic night running gun in the country now. We had eight different stages over a 5K run route up and down a bunch of treacherous hills and terrain with a lot of lasers, lights, disco balls, music blaring, things on fire, just to really get the shooters to where there's a lot going on and they have to process it that at 2 in the morning or whatever their time slot was when they first stepped off to go for this run route. And to see how they can apply their skills as under as much pressure as we can possibly have without having some type of other rounds coming back at them to simulate that. But getting people to where they're screaming in their ear, the music's overwhelming, and there's a lot of distractions and other things that they have to process is the best way that we can take that person to see how well they'll do under stress. And that time's going to reflect of, oh, did the music or the lights re distract you so much to where you're shaking trying to a mag reload? Or did you drop everything on the ground because there's too much going on because you just ran 2.5K to get to this portion and now you're out of breath because you carried too much ammo with you or you're out of shape? So that's getting that extra test. Plus, you're also fatigued because it's 2 in the morning or whatever time you had that step off. We were running 75 people over the weekend and pushing them out constantly on Friday and Saturday night. So
That's
we got a
pretty
lot of people
awesome.
through these courses.
I mean, like just the point you made, like just mentioning like the 2 a.m. piece of it and the I won't say necessarily it's not necessarily exhaustion, but you are tired, things are different, your body is, I mean, it's to a degree it's exhaustion, right? And I think when we have the discussion around like home defense, everyone just assumes, oh, 2 in the morning when I got to jump out of bed and go do something because somebody's in my home. And it's like, yeah, okay, yeah, that's totally plausible based off of, I'm sure, lots of crime statistics I don't have in front of me, right? So, and I think that's actually probably one of the more accurate ways you're going to find to see how you actually do that late at night and perform. I mean, what did you see performance wise? I mean, do people really have those kinds of issues at dropping mags? The general, like, I know it was designed for that, but what was like, I don't know if you had the opportunity to watch it all, but what were you seeing performance standard wise? Especially because I think some people that come out for this are probably dudes that are maybe a little bit more spun up than your average guy.
Yeah, we have a pretty good crowd of people who come from around the country to our run and gun events. So we definitely have a higher level of shooters as an average, but yeah, this is definitely the 2 in the morning test yourself. And hey, you have the opportunity to wear a full kit instead of run around in your underwear and see who's on the other side of your house. Here's the gauntlet at night. Bring everything you want.
So was it like required night vision or just low light or
So
basically
we had
shooter's
two
choice?
divisions. We had white light and then IR. So you either had the opportunity to use white light on your pistol and rifle or everything under IR. So pistol and rifle, only things that emit IR. And that really
Okay.
separated a lot of things for people because we didn't let them use their white lights on their pistol.
So yeah, no override. If you were an IR, it was strictly IR spectrum, everything.
Yep. You're in the dark or you're in the light, your choice.
Yeah. Gee, that actually sounds really awesome. You said what, 75 shooters?
Yes. Yeah, we had a
That's
good
awesome.
turnout this year. Bunch of sponsors, prize tables, guns and suppressors and other night vision optics on there. It was a really good turnout. So excited for next year as well. We're doing it at
Yeah.
the same time.
Is this something that you see people getting a lot of, like, when you, I guess, feedback, like, do people, is this eye-opening just when you see the differences? Because I think, the whole low light thing, I honestly think based off of what you hear, bad stories, and you see body cam footage and stuff like that, right? Like, stuff happens at night. I think, I don't know, I think people kind of underestimate the difficulty of just functioning in the dark, like that lack of your senses. And I think that when we take everything we just talked about in the last, what, 10-ish, 15, whatever minutes it's been, you talk about all those things, the mindset, the stress, and all those things. I feel like taking you out of the comfort of being able to see and being totally aware is, it's not even just like one layer. I feel like it's a multiplier on the difficulty, the discomfort.
Yeah, absolutely. And from the outside looking down and seeing how everyone performed on that, there's a lot of things that are noticeable at night, even white light or night vision. People tend to shoot lower at night for whatever reason. There seems to be more gravity to where most people's grouping are about 4 to 6 inches lower, and that's not just height over bore. It's just kind of a weird phenomenon I've noticed over the years is people tend to shoot lower, but. Other than that, it's a lot of trust in their equipment and having done kit shakeouts before has been the biggest things. Whether someone's using another set of night vision that they loaned from somebody and actually knowing all the controls on there, seen that happen a few times, or just trying to do basic reloads when they're at 2 miles into the course of fire. They've shot half their load of ammo they brought with them, and their heart rate is pretty dang high. Trying to get themselves to settle and remember what it takes to get that back into action, and then also be able to identify the targets and distance. And these aren't crazy distances. 125 yards is as far as we put them out. But when you have cop cars with light sirens and stuff going on next to you, their shadows start to really cast and make it look like that thing's 300 yards away, even though it's just a C-type silhouette. But it starts playing mind games with the different shadows, and depending on what type of night vision you're using, things look a lot further away when you're looking through that little bit of glass. And then depending on what kind of optic you have, probably doesn't have magnification either. So depending on the illumination and what type of what's going on outside, how much light's there, what's flashing around you, shadows start to look weird, and different colors really change under IR. So a big takeaway from this one was the orange targets of all things. Under night vision, all the orange targets, we painted them like Easter egg colors to make it even for IR and white light, but they would just disappear. They were so hard to find any orange targets compared to black or blue or just other ones of how the lights reflect off them. They blended in so well, even with UV lights or disco lights flashing all around them. It was still a real challenge. So understanding what different colors and also camo patterns or materials reflect under different lighting conditions is a big eye-opener for most competitors when they start trying to scan for targets or look and see what's in front of them, and then still be able to use their peripheral vision to navigate through the course of fire and not trip and just smack their face off every tree or rock. That's definitely always something you can tell if someone's trained under their equipment or not, of just how well they are able to do the basic reloads, find a piece of kit off their gear, and just be comfortable with what they're doing, even though their vision is slightly reduced because they're looking through just those tubes, that they know what their body, their kit, their where the weapons and how to implement them under that pressure. It really, really shows it come together when they're at that last stage of the evening and they've been running for an hour plus and trying to engage with different targets that they might forget, oh, that's the wrong mag for this gun. I've seen people try and put pistol mags into their rifle. That's not even the right shape. What are you doing there? But yeah, it's
Well, and
each
you
time
have
there's
to,
something new I learned from other shooters.
yeah, and you as a as the shooter, right? You have to keep in mind, or at the back of your mind, like if you're trying to take this skill and transfer this out of the context, right, the competition context, right, into a real world scenario, right? You're accountable for every round you put down range, and it's not, and I talked about this a little bit. I had Mark Smith on last week. We talked a little bit about this and some of the training scars people pick up because we make like targets and things convenient colors because it's helpful, or it's helpful that, oh, they all look the same, but then we gave them little devices in their hands on the targets, right, to tell you which one was a shooter or no shoot. It's like, but well, how likely is it they're actually gonna, look the same? And to that point, right, understanding how to use those night optics devices, and I love night vision, it's awesome, right? But if to what you're saying, right, if you've never spent a lot of time with it to understand, like, certain fabrics don't really do so well under night vision. Some glow, some don't. Some lose a lot of definition if you don't know how to use your illuminators and your tools and everything. And then, ambient light plays a factor in all those things. How confident are you going to be under all of that stress, whether you just had to run or like, how confident are you that that is for sure a target? And then are you going to be able to neutralize that as a threat? If something like a mass shooter situation, you're trying to do the right thing. And if you're in law enforcement, it's your job. Like, you have to be the guy there because who else is going to, right? You have to understand how all that stuff comes together and works. And it's not, I mean, I think people just assume that it's going to happen. It's actually pretty difficult. Like, even up close with good illuminators and good tubes and everything, like, it's pretty tough to tell some of those colors and things apart because it's basically a black and white spectrum with varying degrees of, lights and dark shades. It's not that easy. And if you don't train with it comes through in the performance really quickly.
Absolutely. And that's something that I put into my night vision classes out here as well, of getting PID on specific targets. How close do you actually need to be when you can see that, yes, that's a person, but is that the right person that you're looking for as well under night vision versus thermal? And it's totally night and day when you start using higher end thermal scopes that you can actually zoom in and get defining features. But for most night vision, even under good lume condition, you're still operating around that 100 yard or in space to actually get a good line of sight and be able to pick things up, especially if there's no ambient light around and you have to use whatever's on your weapon. It's definitely a bigger challenge on the IR spectrum in general, to where depending on if you have to take that shot or not, thermal is probably the right answer for most things. And that's a big takeaway for a lot of these night vision classes that I put on, is night vision isn't the end all be all superpower. Yes, it is a superpower. However, it still has limitations. And compared to thermal, when you can get PID on a target a mile away, well, not a mile, but you can still tell that someone is in the area and have those other indicators pick up, it's a lot easier to start processing that information and then deciding what to do about it. But at the end of the day, I'd rather use night vision for moving and shooting on the move versus thermal is I'm in a static position and I'm on the defense or offense in a hiding spot to where I don't have to worry about that movement portion anymore.
Yeah, and that's what I've been told as well, is that if you have the opportunity to stop and scan, if you're immobile, thermal works really, really well because of the definition that you get out of it. But yeah, on the move, it's just not the most advantageous tool, and that's where night vision becomes, the game changer and the real capability changer, because you can move and shoot, you can shoot, stationary if you have to and things. So again, just people understanding, and realistically, like, are people really ever going to use their night vision in a home defense situation? I mean, like, I hope not, but I mean, maybe, I don't know. I'd rather have it
Unlikely.
if given the choice. Like, I'd rather have it. Do I keep it like next to my bed, set to go? No, I don't know anybody that does, but it would be, it's nice to have. It's cool. If nothing else, this is always. It's fun, right? So we have it because we can. The other thing that we had started off the conversation with was the physical violence side of the conversation. So we talked about applied violence. What is, because I think for a lot of people that line blurs, like, well, you're applying physical violence. What are you talking about? So where's the difference there? What does that come into the conversation at?
That's when you're choosing which weapon to use and what damage you can inflict with it. So, if we just go for the gun for a concealed carry defense situation, being able to effectively put those bullets into that enemy and turn off the electricity. What does it take to turn off the electricity into that person? If you are already at that green light of your rules of engagement or your threat level, whatever gave you that, yes, it is time to engage this person before they take my life. What does it take to do that? And it's understanding, well, what parts of the human need to be incapacitated as quickly as possible, whether you're getting to the nervous function, or again, just turning the electricity off on the person, whether it's from the brain, the spine, or into any other type of joint that's going to immobilize them. What's going to be the most effective, best use of my time and my capability? So whether it's going for the head or the spine or any other vital organs in the chest cavity to stop that person from doing whatever acts of violence that they're about to or in the middle of doing is going to give you that best result. And the gun is the easiest option for most people these days once they have a good understanding of how they can shoot a target effectively. Being able to call your shot is the basic requirement that I usually give people when they say, hey, am I good to conceal carry? Well, can you call your shot? Do you know what's going to happen every time you pull that trigger? Or do you have a good understanding of what is supposed to happen, at least, of how do you hold the gun right, press the trigger without moving it? Those things. If you can't even get to that step, you're probably just going to start mag dumping in that general direction, like most law enforcement guys do in
I
a
was just
lot
going
of
to say,
higher profile students.
yep. Yeah, you see that
Yeah.
stuff and it gets real, real crazy. Dumping a whole 17 rounds and then they're reloading on the move and they haven't hit anything yet. And that's, I'm not trying to make a dig here. That's just like reality, man. Like, there's a lot of
Yeah.
that out there.
The statistics are out there of how many shots fired per perpetrator hit. It's ridiculously low. And then the concealed carry side of things, there is slightly more, I guess, accounted rounds at that point, people that actually put them into the target or the enemy. But the physical side of things is what happens if you put a 9 mil into someone's face? What is the reaction that it's going to have on that body, the gun in their hand, the knife, or whatever their weapon is that they're using? Is that going to stop them dead in their tracks? Or are they on some type of other drug that they don't realize they've been fatally shot, but they're still moving? And that's when it comes down to how many rounds does it take to shoot someone? I get that question quite often. And the answer that most instructors will tell you is however many it takes to get them to stop doing what they're doing, whether it's
Stop
cutting
the
their head
threat.
off with a wall of lead, or it turning them into a bloody pulp on the ground that is unrecognizable. That is a ensuring way that they will not be able to continue what they were doing. But how many rounds do you have with you? Or do you only have a pocket knife or your fist or a bar stool? What's the thing to your left and right? And I remember in high school, my dad always told me, hey, if there's a school shooter, grab the flagpole and use that. Like, that's the most American self-defense thing I think I could possibly do. But yeah, really, it's that or a desk chair. Like if someone did walk into the high school, what do you have around you that you could use to stop that person or interfere with what they're doing? And deciding, what am I going to use or try, and what's in my hand? Can I distract them? Can I incapacitate them by throwing something at them and hitting them in the head? Am I that good of a thrower even? It comes down to understanding what your capabilities are. And a lot of those capabilities, when it comes to this sense of the physical violence, you can test yourself in a variety of sports. So whether it's jiu-jitsu, MMA, boxing, a lot of those warrior style sports translate over to the shooting world. When you get to your footing and how you move your body and carry your weight around, makes a real big difference when it's time to go against somebody, whether it's in a force on force training or it's in a actual situation when some bad guy is there trying to do harm. What can you physically do with your arms? Can you put them in a chokehold and subdue them? Or are you too small and frail to where you have to escape and run away or use anything else at the last minute? Because there's a lot of guys that they have a gun, they have their concealed carry training from whatever their state is in, but
Yeah.
they don't realize that someone's going to snatch that gun right out of your hand because he's meaner than you. There's a
Yeah,
lot of violent people out there that aren't scared of guns.
and it's not it, I think that it's the part of the conversation, truthfully, where the ego, I think, creeps in the most, and to some degree the false confidence, where people again kind of assume that what they know how to do, what they can do is it's actually more damaging to them than it is helpful. I see this stuff. We go out on Thursdays, and we do structure clearance training or CQB training on at Thursdays at a local place around here. And when I introduce the concept to folks, like, hey, we're gonna start doing cover contact drills. Just cardboard targets, nothing crazy, right? If it's brown, shoot it. If we turn around and it's white, don't. Just basic processing and understanding. So, trying to get people again past some of this stuff using like Mantis units, nothing crazy, right? Mostly because it's not a live fire shoot house anyways, but getting people in the habit of, hey, put more than two rounds on a target, and then also how to understand how to build angles with your buddies and not, flag each other and stuff like that. And getting pushback on the concept of a cover contact drill. Because, well, I shot the target six times. I go, okay, well, did you really? And A, it's not like it's cardboard, it's not a human body. Are you a doctor? Do you know what's going to incapacitate them? Well, I shot him six times. Where did you hit him? Do you know for sure? Are those rounds all going to, are those in, to borrow the phrase, right? Are they going to turn the electricity off, right? Are they going to do what you think that those rounds did? If they weren't good hits, then you could. I mean, there's a number out there somewhere, I'm sure. You could probably shoot a human body, something like 13 or 20 plus times and still not completely incapacitate the individual. I'm sure someone's got a story like that out there. So it's not what we're doing, it's why we're doing this. And take the ego out of it and understand that you're training to end the threat, not just to shoot the cardboard with a laser. Like, obviously, the cardboard's not going to hurt you. And people actually get, and why I bring this up is people actually get upset about that. They get upset being told, like, you just half-assed that. No, well, it's cardboard. I don't care. Well, it's not like we're here to solve this issue. We're here to get better at this. Shoot it more than twice, and then you guys need to hold a gun on it and put hands on it. It's supposed to mimic subduing, right, an individual, because as a concealed carrier, this is what you would do. Guys got super bent out of shape about it. And I don't understand. It's like, it's not that I'm saying you wouldn't kill somebody if you shot him six times, guy. What I'm saying is don't train yourself into believing that that's it every single time. Ironically, this was the same dude that the next rep, when he went through, put him in a room with two no-shoot targets and he shot both of them three times. It's like, yeah, dude, you're crushing it, bro. You're gonna shoot everything, even the stuff you're not supposed to. Great. And I think when we talk about the value of folks training and mentally taking some of that applied violence, combining it with the understanding and the physical side of it, like I think based off what we've said here, like you have to have both pieces of that, and it has to be a continuous thought process. You mentioned it earlier, that just pure aggressive nature, One of my favorite things to hear out of fucking idiots on the internet is, when I get pissed, bro, I just see red. And it's like, cool. So you stop thinking. So you've lost all processing. You know what I mean? And it's just the dumbest shit you could possibly say. And to try to validate your abilities in a physical altercation or some kind of violent interaction with firearms or whatever have you.
Yeah, exactly. That's the same cop that says, "Oh, I don't need to go to a training class. I get enough from my department." He sees red. He just
Yeah,
does.
no. That no cop, no police agency in America, for the most part anyways, gets enough training time just from work.
Exactly.
I don't think
Yeah.
anyways. That's not the story I ever get, ever.
I haven't either. But yeah, that's definitely the thing that people get their ego humbled, and that's generally why I see them get aggressive or turned away from it, like from your point of them not understanding, or they start seeing that they're not truly capable of doing what they think they can. So they just wash it off and laugh it off as, "Oh, it's just this. It's just this." Because their ego can't handle that they can't do what they think they can do because they haven't taken that training to the next level of increasing that pressure and standard of having a higher standard and expectation. Then you're going to have that better understanding of what you can actually do versus mag dumping in the trash like most people do at the range. But
Yes. And thankfully our range actually has rules against that stuff. They try to, but yeah, and it's really just disheartening because I think it builds a lot of false confidence. I think it sets up so many people for failure. And in the event that it actually happened, I think you'd see some really, really poor outcomes from guys who would otherwise, oh, I was a Marine. Hey man, cool. Nothing against your service, but at this you're piss poor at this. So I'm not saying what you did, and I don't even know. I mean, it could have been I don't want to say, how should I put this? You could be a cook in the Marines, and every Marine's a rifleman, so I'm not saying you have no skill, but I don't know what your role was, bro. You could have worked on trucks, and that's a great skill to have. Not necessarily for self-defense, but it's a great skill to have. It's almost not relative to the discussion at hand now because you're no longer in that service role. You're no longer qualifying, training, doing these things on a regular basis. So it's almost like a completely separate part of the equation. It at least has I
yeah.
see.
And that I agree with that. And that's a discussion I've had with a lot of other vets too, when they get out and they start when the identity crisis inevitably comes. It's, "Hey, remember, you don't have that platoon of riflemen to your left and right to be able to do that same thing that you did while you were downrange or trained to do. You're not part of a unit anymore. It is on you to figure out what you can actually do and not expect to have a saw gunner and a 240 gunner to your left and right. This is all on your skill and capability now." So while they might have a lot more aggression and bravado towards it, is that skill backing it up too? There's a lot of false sense of capability of what you can actually do from a lot of younger guys that get out think that, "All right, I was infantry, I was a HUA, I'm ready to go back to, I can fight anyone in the stateside, I'm ready to go." But then if you start looking at it objectively, well, what did you have that was brought to you? You had your weapons, you had this type of training for this type of shooting. Is that what you're doing now? Concealed carry is one of the least taught techniques in all of the military that I've seen, from all the different branches as well. It's not, pistol shooting is such a low standard and also low importance compared to almost any other job or skill set that it gets overlooked so easily. And then when people come out and start shooting on their own, they realize that they have this huge gap in their capabilities from the M4 or whatever other sniper rifle that they were trained on, that it does not apply over to the handgun that they carry every day. And it's a whole nother world to open up and skill set to start developing that they don't have as much backing as they thought they did, which is the big humbler for most people that luckily people can get more people are getting over instead of relying on, "Oh yeah, I used to qualify on that back in the day. I got my expert M9 badge sitting on my old uniform." But either
Well, and
way.
I mean, I think that it's no disrespect to any of those guys, and certainly I think it probably does give them some level of a mental advantage, just having the mindset if they have ever been in combat, certainly, or even if they've just been through a level of training that's going to be greater than that of the average guy, right? But that alone is not enough, right? So, to your point, right? You don't have, you're not guaranteed to have friends on your left and your right. The pistol bit, I assumed, and I think Marines were issued sidearms, if I remember correctly from what I was told. But I was very surprised to find out like just how few sidearms are issued in like the Army, and like in the Navy. And like, yeah, most of the time you don't get a sidearm unless you're somebody special or something. And I'm like, okay, or you're a certain rank or role that just, that's how it works out. So, yeah, to your point, it's actually crazy how many people come out. They get a CPL after service, which is not hard to get. You just have to complete the liability course that the state mandates that you get. and then people assume that they are going to be ready to deploy that handgun, and they may be ready to, but are they going to be capable, right, and effective with it? Are they going to know what to do with it? And that's where I start having some clicks. I've had friends that are former service guys, and they're great people. They make some of the dumbest decisions in terms of carry weapons. I have like, oh yeah, I
Yeah.
really wanted
Oh yeah.
the M45 A1, whatever the 1911 that the Marines had for a minute there.
Yeah.
Really want one of those. I'm like, cool, those things look sick. He's like, yeah, so I bought this thing that looks just like it. I'm like, oh cool, you bought a foreign made piece of crap with, he put a light on it. The light flew off the end. I'm like, all right, great. You're gonna carry this, sick dude. And then it went for the opposite end of the spectrum to like a Glock 43X. I'm like, okay, maybe that's a better choice. I think he's finally ended up somewhere in the middle with like a 19 or a 17, whatever. But just because you're able to deploy the tool does not mean you're gonna be able to use that tool. And that's both like, are you ready to do it mentally, and are you physically proficient enough to, like you said, call your shot, right? And I think that for some people, that's why I think it's so important to encourage your friends and your buddies and yourself, right, to train with some kind of a shot timer, something that's going to apply some level of stress or some standard of performance. I've seen tons of people, I've trained with some guys, they don't believe in the shot timer. They only believe in accuracy. And I'm like, I think that's a, I think you're building a house on like a busted foundation, man. I don't know that that's really gonna help you at all. It doesn't make any sense to me.
You're missing the pressure of a time constraint. And if you create realistic scenarios and add the time constraint of you walk around a corner and some gangbanger sticks a gun towards you and says, "Give me all your shit." How fast can you give them your shit? Is it a gun or is it the wallet?
Right.
What is the actual time of, can you distract them with that? What does that look like when you start breaking it down to metrics? I'm not a big math guy, but the shot clock is the kind of math I like to look at to understand of, okay, if my fanny pack draw to target at 7 yards to an A zone is 3.5 seconds, okay, that would be something to consider of, hey, I'm at this situation. This guy got the jump on me because I was distracted by something else going on. And then he comes around and has a knife or gun. How long would it actually take me to draw and implement that, or him to just press the trigger if he's already got me dead to rights? Am I able to use that time for him to process, oh, I'm fighting back? Or is he already super aggressive and ready to go to where I need to grab that gun from him? What does that distance and time space look like? And how do I instantly create that snapshot of frame the situation? What's going on? What do I have with me? And what can I do about it? So
And
that's a big thing a lot of guys are missing then without the shot clock.
I think that that speaks also to like the fal like well, I shouldn't say fallacy, but I mean the combatives piece of the discussion that a lot of guys want to bring into it, and they guarantee the most important thing you can do for your self-defense is not shooting. Oh, it's jujitsu, because if you don't do this, you're gonna get your ass beat all the time. And I'm like, okay, I think that, maybe it's one of those things, right, where if you overindulge any one of these disciplines, it's going to set you up for failure, and certainly I'm guilty of that. Like 100%, I do not train combatives. I probably should. And I think a lot of the guys though that get into some of the combat sports stuff assume that that alone is enough in instances. And it's why we talk about being well-rounded being important, right? You're just talking about with time. reactive action or proactive action and things are real, and understanding how quickly you can respond to a threat, whether that's if you're close enough to throw a kick, are you able to draw your firearm? Do you know how to draw your firearm and accurately fire from retention? That's something that unless you actually go seek that training out, that's a very unique thing. The first time I had to do that, I felt so fucking uncomfortable. Like, you want me to
Yeah,
do
you get the muzzle blast in
what
your
now?
face from the hip or somewhere. That's a different feeling.
Just, well, even just like going through the draw and then like, you're firing from retention. So it's going off like right next to you and you're like, okay, where's my elbow again? And what am I doing? And what I, you want me to just shoot from here? And it's very, I think it's one of those things, again, people just assume you'll be able to do it when the time comes. It's really uncomfortable the first, probably, I would say the first 5 times I did it. I seriously was afraid I was going to do something wrong. Either I was going to shoot myself in the elbow or the other arm or the leg or something. And it's really not that bad once you get over it and figure out, and as long as you have a qualified and like instructor teaching you. But even with the combative stuff too, I brought up Craig Douglas earlier with I believe he's with ShivWorks, I think is his company. I hope that's right. I'm gonna be dropping all kinds of bad references on this one. It's so embarrassing. But I mean, like, people assume, oh, well, I carry a blade, so I'm all right. Well, do you know how to use it? Do you know how to fight to get to that? I mean, that this is always assuming you're at an even standoff or you have the benefit of distance too, right? This whole conversation of like applying violence, physical violence, you don't always get to choose, right? So, it's not always a hey, stick them up, give me your wallet type thing, right? So it's a actually it's a, the more you get into it, it's a pretty fucking depressing conversation. Like the reality of what could happen is pretty fucking depressing. It's
It is.
not a good
It
day.
definitely is. And yeah, one more thing to add to the aggression and the different sports. So, like getting stuck into jiu-jitsu only or just boxing. Jiu-jitsu, I've had a conversation with buddies that they're black belts. They're up there. If you try and put me in a guard, I'm going to punch you in the junk or the throat. I'm not going to be playing your game. I'm going to hurt you very badly because I've been in street fights growing up. I've been in bar fights. I understand there's other dirty areas that you can hit someone that these sports don't allow. And when it comes to shooting, well, what's the dirty thing that you can do there? What's the cheating advantage you can get that's gaming it? But on that side of things, how do you move around different obstacles and create that space and time to where you have the upper hand? Shoot, move, communicate, it's the military saying. So how do you apply that to your concealed carry situation? You got to shoot them from just squared off, standing there in the Wild West, womp, womp, draw and bring it up, or do you have to let him know that you're about to shoot him? Probably not if he's distracted with someone else or some other situation. Like speed is security at the end of the day. If you can move yourself around to where he probably can't hit a moving target too, that builds you a lot more space in that situation. But yeah, getting a lot of the people that have these conversations or start getting tunneled into one of their sports as the end all be all probably haven't been in a lot of bar fights or high school fights growing up too, to realize, hey, that guy just grabbed his shoe and clobbered you with it. I didn't know that would be a weapon or something else that was in their hands or their waist or their wingspan. What else can they grab and utilize against you? Well, that's one of the things that cops always look at. What's their hands doing? What's in their waistband and what's in their wingspan to try and be used against you in any place? So it's not
And
just
it
the what do they have, what's their intent as well.
well, and it's not, and that's again for people listening, it's not to say that there's no value in those skills, but I don't think it's just like in those altercations, why you were successful was because you know jujitsu. It's because of what you get out of it, right? So you're athletic, you're in good shape, you have faster response times, your processing speed is probably faster because you're used to rolling around. Oh, hey, look, he's gonna grab my leg. I'm gonna do this. You know what I mean? Like you're on the or in the moment problem solving is very similar, right? To competitive shooting is faster. Now, contextually, there's probably some give and take to that, but I'm not trying to take anything from any of it. I'm just saying that, again, like one
Same.
single thing is not going to be the cheat code that gives you guaranteed success. And there is no guarantee of success, realistically. And I've heard this from people, obviously that have done all kinds of stuff in all kinds of places around the world, all kinds of people. You can do everything right and still lose. You know what I mean? It's just, it is what it is. You can prepare as much as you can to try and slide that in your favor, But it is what it is. It's you know, your time, then you can't do anything about it. But yeah, there's no like cheat code to it. There's just what you can do to prepare for it. And I think that personally, I think the mindset piece of being able to keep a level head of yourself, if you had to put one at the top of the list, and I don't know what you would say, but I think that that's going to give you the best advantage of anything else. Just because, you know, like we talked about the raw aggression thing, really cool. I love that. Although typically, I think you get like what 1 or 2 minutes, and then a lot of those people usually really gas themselves, and then they lose the ability to do a lot of the things that they need to do from a motor skills standpoint. But being able to, you know, kind of control some of that, mentally process what's going on, I think the mindset piece, I'll maintain that that I think is the best tool for anyone in any situation is what's between your ears.
I definitely agree with that. It's framing the situation of what's going on and what can I do about it. And then do I have the physical capacity to do it, whether it's just my body, what's my athleticism level? Or what tools do I have to make up for that lack of athleticism or to make it significantly easier, such as having a gun versus a knife? I don't have to run over to that situation. I can stay back here and take that accurate shot.
Yeah, and that's
Right.
funny too. I was told by a buddy who had started doing competitive shooting. He put a post up something about like you should go out and you should go try competitions. You should go try shooting. And just FYI, no matter what you do, no matter how hard you work before your first competition, you're still gonna get smoked by a fat guy in a Hawaiian shirt. And I'm like, so depressing,
Yep.
bro. Like, but probably realistic. 'Cause I mean, you look at some of those champion level shooters. I just think of Taron Butler, if I'm being honest, like not the most fit guy, you know.
No.
It actually makes me think of that scene. I don't know if you ever seen the movie Kingpin, the bowling movie with
Yeah.
Woody Harrelson, and there's that
Yeah.
whole dialogue that Randy Quaid has about like, oh my God, it's so intimidating to be surrounded by so many fantastic athletes, and it's just like a montage of like fat, balding dudes eating like nachos and drinking beer and stuff, and I'm like, that is funny. And then you think about some of the stuff, you know, on the competition shooting side of things, and it's like, well, yeah, I can see some connections there. Not a ton, because there's a lot of really just like athletically gifted and fit guys that I think like JJ Rakaza and stuff, dudes that are just
Yeah.
good shape. They're great athletes and they're good shooters. But there's definitely the other side of that spectrum as well.
That's kind of what I've been noticing a lot in USPSA over the last few years is you're getting a good divide, a healthier divide of the tactical athletes, if you want to call it that, or people that are more focused on modern strength and conditioning. My buddy Alex over at Intrepid Defense in Missouri, he's got an awesome program working with people to get them in shape and programmed up physically, and then also working on the shooting aspect of it too, tailored to what their specific mission is. And that's a big piece that is lacking in a lot of these competitive sports because it is like golf, but you have a slightly different change of pace and tools and what the game is at that point, where you'll have a 300-pound dude out there who has a master, a grandmaster class rating. Well, he figured out the laziest ways to be most effective with shooting that across the courses of fire. He doesn't have to step in, he can't use his athleticism. He uses his weight to slow him down and stabilize, but to take those shots that he in his head can be more effective for moving his weight around. He understands the gaming side of it to where sending certain split follow-up shots at different distances from different angles requires less overall movement versus you guys got guys like Alex and a whole bunch of other world champs running around that are just primal beasts. These guys are actual athletes that have the gun in their hand now and use their athleticism to move across the course of fire, to understand where their center of gravity is at and how to implement the fast reload, that target transition, preemptively aiming, and being able to run up, hit that target at 5 yards away and run over to the next position and zap a popper at 25 on the move because they know that they can stabilize themselves after they've caught their footing, turning it to a different position. Versus a guy who runs in one spot and then takes a bunch of long shots and then runs to another spot, takes more long shots, and then gets to the close ones that he has to. The overall time is going to be possibly comparable, generally faster from the athlete, but the scores are going to reflect that the guy who's more athletic and able to move around has an easier time to take those higher or lower percentage shots, lower percentage of being accurate, that is, versus someone who's standing back, taking a weird lean or some other type of situation that they don't want to move as much. So that's it's cool to watch that shift happen. And the tactical games has definitely been a big promoter of it, even though it's CrossFit with bullseye shooting.
Yeah, it does. I have mixed feelings on the tactical games thing. It does still feel like you said, CrossFit. I'm sorry, and the jokes write themselves with the CrossFit people. Like it didn't ever stop being funny to me. But yeah, you add shooting into it, and I mean, and it's really good stuff. I think that if it's what something. So somebody wants to do that's gonna help enable them to be more fit to get closer to what they should be doing. Like, I think it's a good thing. It's not maybe my thing, but I think once people do start understanding the advantages they get to that, you do start to see more people leaning into the gym, getting a stronger routine, understanding like, hey, it's not always about adding a bunch of muscle bulk or even just necessarily losing a ton of weight, which you should do. You should try to do both things, like, gain more muscle, lose fat. Those are both good things, but really understanding like, well, again, the adjacent benefits. Well, if you work on your rear delts, it's going to help with your rifle and being able to carry that and support that and do that for extended periods of time, right? With what you're trying to do, whether that's competition shooting, and you just struggle creating a stable platform for yourself because you just don't have any upper body strength, or you're trying to work on, structure clearance, and that requires you to hold the gun up for extended periods of time, and you don't want to get hurt. I mean, like, dumb injuries happen from shooting. I got tennis elbow from taking a 3-day CQB class, and it was like
Oh yeah.
gayest shit
Seen
I've
that.
ever experienced in my life. I'm like, what? You got one of those stupid bands on my arm and everything, and I'm like, I can't do this anymore. This is dumb. But it happens. Your back does weird shit when you get older and everything. I sound like I'm 80. It's dumb. I've never experienced more personal injuries than when I got into shooting. And it was all just little stuff, but it's just annoying as hell.
Right, that's what happens, especially the more stressful the an endurance style shooting competitions that you get involved in. I mean, CQB is an athletic endeavor. Running around with that weighted in your hands, a rifle or pistol all day will start fatiguing muscles that if it's not part of your normal workout routine, you're going to instantly notice. I joke all the time with people that I go to the gym to grow my gun muscles, but it's actually true. I do want to be able to have all these stabilizer muscles, able to hold that pistol up and lock it down. Or that rifle or that long gun, and not have those additional muscle shakes or cramps come up when I'm at the 9 out of 10K shooting position and I still got to run with a whatever ruck size or weight on my back too, or the next obstacle I have to climb. Because if I can't physically do that, then I'm going to get stuck in that position, which has almost happened many times of lactic acid building up on some of these longer stress events. But it's awesome to see over the years. Like, for this will be our 10th annual Legion Memorial Run and Gun, where we host a 5K and 10K course of fire over 2 days, honoring those who have passed from 5th Special Forces Group. This year will be MACV SOG vets that we're honoring as well. So we're going to have
Oh, yeah.
a hell of an event, bringing those guys out to meet all the current 5th Special Forces guys and command team, and bringing them all together, generations of war fighters. But our courses of fire are very physically demanding, to where you're climbing, you're over, under, around all kinds of obstacles that would be something that they would have had to face in those situations and win the battle for them. But we're not light on those, to where you need to be a true athlete to complete that with the skill set of shooting under stress and accurately on the clock. So that's as close as we can get that to simulating what they had to go through. And that's the best way we can honor these people, is winning the fight for those who were killed in action or MIA. And for the last 10 years of these running guns going on, it's awesome to see guys that change their entire diet and workout program because they realize the fifth bag of Cheetos and Tornados from the gas station has really taken a toll on their capability. And they'll have guys that were 300 pounds a couple of years ago that are now sitting at 180 at 15% body fat, because they realized how much more of an asset that they could be if they started taking their diet, their sleep, and their just overall health into the next, just following the journey.
Yeah.
Like any other sports, there's a journey to get to the top level, and athleticism is a huge foundation portion of it.
Yeah,
So.
I suck at the sleep part of it. My sleep schedule blows. I don't sleep when I should or how I should. It's, and honestly, I've had a couple of people tell me that like you'd probably see better like weight loss results and stuff. And I don't know the physiology behind it, but I know that sleep is a huge part of it. It's probably one of the more overlooked parts of it in, 2026 when we all, I mean, I had a monster today, right? Like, oh, hey, you're going to, a 3-day training class. Just pack a case of Monster and a case of water and then, sandwich stuff and you'll be fine. We just fuel ourselves off of, a continuous intake of caffeine. I know my sleep schedule's totally screwed up. Like bad. I'll stay up till I don't know how to say this out loud. It's like 1:30 in the morning and then get up at 6:30 or 7 o'clock for work. And then that's, and then on the weekend I just play
Yeah.
catch up with my sleep cycle and it's just not the way it's supposed to work. Is not.
No, it's something you got to force, and I'm guilty of it as well. I actually have a CPAP machine that if I wear for days that I know I have a significant event the next day, it does make a difference. Sleep apnea is a real bitch, but
I tried the what's the melatonin. So I was like,
oh
I'll
yeah.
take melatonin, that'll knock me out. And it does. And cool, right? And then I was taking it continue. I was having a lot of trouble sleeping due to some stuff that was going on in life at the time. And I took it for like 2 weeks straight. And you know what? When I hit the point of waking up the next morning in tears, can't remember why. Don't know what I was dreaming about, but I was like, this is getting too weird. I'm done. I'm not doing this shit anymore. So
Yeah.
that kind of scratched the medicinal route off of the sleep therapy shit. I'm like, the only other time that shit's happened to me was when I came out of like I had my wisdom teeth pulled and they knocked me out, right? And I woke up and in the recovery room and instantly started crying. I'm like, I have no idea what the hell's going on. Does something hurt? What's wrong? I go, I have no idea. Yeah, the sleep thing's huge and find a way to make it work. God, and for some, yeah, if you have a bad reaction to melatonin, don't suffer through it. That was terrible. That was terrifying. I'm never doing that again.
No, that was a big thing I learned while downrange as well, of controlling the sleep, of being ready when it's time to go. But also, we were get prescribed Ambien. If you're staying up for too many days because too much caffeine consumption or other pills that are prescribed to stay up for whatever mission it is, hey, here's your uppers and your downers. And then I started realizing on days that you
Yeah.
had a lot of either just caffeine, or you would get spooled up to do something and then have to stand around and wait, or it would get canceled. Well, now I'm all jacked up on caffeine and it's 3 in the morning and I'm sitting around with nothing to do. All right, now I'm gonna go to bed. That's probably not gonna happen at this point. I need to physically exhaust my body and my mind too. There'll be many days that'll be working on a computer just 18 hours, banging something out on the laptop or the workstation, and then realize, oh, I need to go to bed and then lay down there and stare at the sky or whatever, the roof, for hours and go, huh, I didn't work out today. That's what I was missing in today that is keeping my mind stirring so much that I want to go to bed, but physically I have no reason to because I didn't do anything compared to the last week of exhaustion and physical
Right.
exertion.
Yeah,
Now,
it's
yeah, definitely agree that sleep makes a huge difference, and trying to get that 6 to 8 hours, depending on your body type. I've noticed a significant change in my daily routine of waking up generally with the sun and going to bed, hopefully before midnight, depending on how many side quests I find throughout the night or other projects that pop up.
Yeah.
But
That's
yeah, it
and
makes a
that's the thing
difference.
too. There's always more stuff to get done, and people are like, oh yeah, don't, waste your time and take advantage and do side projects and go train and go lift. And it's like, I mean, it's there's a balance to it. It's tough. And then life on top of that, like I still want to spend time with my wife. I still want to find time
Yeah.
to go do recreational activities that bring me joy, like go see a movie or I sent you all those pictures and I went to the Autorama and stuff.
Yeah.
And I love that stuff. I still want to have the time to go do those things, on top of all that. So it is a balance, which is why it's so upsetting that people think that it's just like, oh, well, if you just cut out fast food, you'd be in better shape. You must not want to. I'm like, well, I don't think it's ever that cut and dry for anybody. Like, just do the things you're supposed to do, and I think for the most part, the results will follow. But it may not be the fastest route to the goal. I mean, I don't know. I'm still working on it, so I don't have a whole lot of answers for folks.
Yeah, the diet's the biggest thing for me that going from working inside to outside now at the range, running around and having to pre-pack every meal that I take out with me. I eat about 5 meals a day and eat about 4,500 calories or so, depending on what I'm doing, just to keep that nice baseline, which is a lot of food. And to have it all be healthy is definitely something I have to think about before I go to Aldi or Costco or Sam's or the local Amish butcher, which is nice to have access to higher quality food that's not covered in all the HGH or whatever the
Chemicals.
bad toxins
Yeah.
that are spread on there. I go to Amish Tim and say, "Hey man, I need a quarter of a cow over here. I need a quarter beef," and he'll dice one up and we'll take it back to the house.
That's I see, and I need to do more of that. We bought a deep freezer. I think it's for any home, having like a deep freezer is probably one of the best investments just for that, because you can go, even if the market or the Amish market or butcher or whatever is not that close, you can go get a large order of whatever you need, right? Whether that's, I don't know, ground beef and steak and whatever, and then you can just store that. You don't have to make continuous trips back and forth and everything. And they're not bad. I think I got one from Costco for like $300. It's really not that bad.
Yeah.
It also keeps my ice cream very cold. So good with the bad, you know. But it, yeah, it's a definite process. And the diet thing is huge. It's actually not that bad eating clean. It's just, you just have to dedicate yourself to it and figure out what you like and then have a couple options. I've found that if I'm only doing, we did this when I got married. My wife was like, "Oh, we're just going to do chicken and fish." And I, dude, I'll tell you, after like 3.5 weeks of nothing but chicken and fish, I was ready to do disgusting things to get my hands on a burger. It was very difficult for me. It was very difficult. Now it worked. I went from like, I think I'm at my heaviest. I was like 290, 295. And I got down when I got married, I was at 236.
Wow.
Works.
Yeah.
It was work. But I was not very pleasant to be around for a little bit. It was kind of like when I, you know, we had a couple of years when I went on family vacation. My mom decided that was the time to quit smoking. Like, yeah. Not
Oh
fun.
boy.
Not fun. Yeah, it was not good. But at any rate, man, I know we're kind of pushing up on our time here and everything, and certainly a good conversation. I think really relevant to what all of us are working on. And I know you threw some stuff out there the last time we had you on, but where can people reach you, and what was the name of that event supporting McAfee SOG again? You said it was a 10th annual, but I forgot the name.
Yeah, that's the 10th annual Legion Memorial Running Gun. So you
Okay.
can find the more info about that on the Cedar Creek Precision website. I have a tab at the top that has it all laid out for what's coming up this year. That'll be September 5 and 6. So we're hosting a 5K and 10K running gun. Fair warning, it sells out in 60 seconds every year. This is one of the hottest matches people try and get into. It's one of those, if you're not ready to hit now, buy now on practice score, it's probably going to be sold out by the time you're putting in your credit card info, just to be honest. But we're always looking for more sponsors and people that want to come out and hang out, especially if anyone in the region is hearing this. We are fully family friendly, spectator oriented. We have side demo bays, sponsors, family days. This is a big event that we want to draw people out to, even if you can't compete. There's going to be something out there for you to do, people to meet, and things to see.
Yeah.
So,
And supporting a really good cause too. I mean, as I was gonna ask, like, people come watch and just check it out if you're not competing. It sounds like
yeah.
that's definitely the case. So
And all proceeds go to, sorry, all proceeds go to the Special Forces Association Chapter 38, which is our local fifth group chapter that go back to the Gold Star families as well. So this is all in-house charity ran. And one of the most fun things you can do with the guns in the woods.
Yeah, I mean that sounds like an incredible way to spend a day or several days, honestly. So definitely, if you're listening to this and you want to check it out, I obviously encourage everybody, if you can, go. We do some stuff like this up here in Michigan. Nothing that sounds that cool. And I have a couple buddies that put together events. They're going to listen to this and probably razz me for that. But do better, guys. I don't know what to tell you. But John, man, it was awesome catching up and sitting down and chatting again. I really, really appreciate it. I'm sure we'll probably do one of these again in the future here. But It was great chatting. You stay safe, and we'll be in touch, man.
Sounds good, Austin. I appreciate it.
Okay, so immediately wanted to start by saying I definitely fucked up in the introduction by referencing Mr. Craig Douglas, I believe, of ShivWorks. So it was a Tony Blauer reference, and no fear, like knowing fear. But it was a great conversation with John. It's not something that we've really gotten into here a lot. It's not something, to be fair, I don't really feel that comfortable addressing it like myself in like a solo discussion or something like that, because I didn't serve. I wasn't in law enforcement. I've never really been put in those situations. So to bring that to you guys in a way that would be helpful and educational, not really my place. I'm happy to take part in the conversation, obviously, because we just did that and it was fantastic. But it's not something that I would feel comfortable doing. Nonetheless, it's super important. It ties so much into a lot of the stuff that we get into when we talk about training here. And John hit on a lot of it with a lot of what he shared and what he said. And we talked about ego. We talked about the emotional side of things. I mean, also the practical side of things with understanding what you're going to be able to do to incapacitate an opponent, right? The steps you're going to be able to take to render that enemy in unable, right, to continue fighting you. And that, because that's really the standard that we as prepared civilians have to hold ourselves to is some of the stuff we're taught in CPL classes, for instance, right? Like, how many times did you shoot? Why did you shoot this many times? Whatever. It's not the shoot to kill thing. You're like almost coached to not say that in your CPL classes because, in a legal standpoint, or from a legal standpoint, rather, what it could mean for you is I shot until I stopped the threat, which could be any number of rounds based off of the physical condition of your adversary at that time. Additionally, it could be, you know, if you're fighting with a bladed weapon, you know, how many times did you stab them? I stopped, you know, when they stopped. And that kind of processing and understanding is something that you need to be aware of, you need to be cognizant of. And there's a lot of data out there that show people in those times of stress when they react, when you're in that fight or flight mode, and how you react and how you respond, like how many times you think that you shot somebody or stabbed them or whatever. Like, oh, four. Are you sure? Yep, 4 times. Like, you shot them 22 times. And those kinds of things do happen. And I know there's like some psychological stuff that plays into that part of it, but I think that when you're talking about everything that we talked about here, it's in the conversation. It's definitely a part of it. And a lot of us, like we got into this too, we found a way to convince ourselves that we're going to be ready at a moment's notice for whatever happens. And that's really probably not the case unless you're somebody who did this stuff professionally for several years. And even then, that's not a guarantee that you're going to win. It's not a guarantee you're going to be ready, right? Like, the whole OODA loop thing, situationally, we like to apply it, right, to any situation with it, like a gunfight, right? CQB, when you're talking about making your room entry, you see them before they see you, you reset their OODA loop, you win, and all that kind of stuff. But it really, on a grander scale, can be applied too, because mentally, if you're not ready to respond and react to those situations, you know, on a broad scale, like just in general, you're not ready to react, you don't know how to react, people freeze. You know, and it's a total processing failure. And that's something that, yes, you have to overcome, and you can only overcome it through training. And that could be through any number of things, right? Certainly firearms training in a competitive setting. We just had, again, I'll reference Mark Smith again. He brought it up last week in our discussion that people who have done things in the military at an extremely high level against adversaries, right, have actually come out and said they are more stressed, right, in a competitive setting for competitive shooting, much like what John was referencing here in this discussion, right, than they were when they were in those quote-unquote life or death situations doing things operationally. So finding ways to put yourself in a stressful situation to evaluate your skill, but then also having done the pre-work, right, having done the training, having put the time in, developed your skill to understand what you're capable of, to know and be able to do those things on demand, right, is a huge part of this. And it's very easy to say these things. It's very easy to, and I understand how stupid this sounds coming from somebody who literally creates content like this and puts it out there to try and engage the algorithm, because you got to play the game if you want to win the game, right? But it's very easy to perform these things against paper, against cardboard, to an extent, against role players that don't shoot back. There's levels of escalation that we can take to try and mimic the situations, the consequences to some degree, right, of decision making, good and bad, and the instances and scenarios that we're likely to find ourselves in. That's why combatives courses, like what comes to mind is like Rogue Methods, like Raul Martinez's courses and stuff. that comes to mind, where it's a lot of, you know, hand on hand fighting and fighting for a weapon and stuff like that. And there's other classes and stuff too, right? But are you able to actually work your way through that stuff? Do you know how to run a gun well enough that you're going to be able to just draw and end the fight there? Because here's the thing, how many people actually spend the time, and I will say wholeheartedly, I am guilty of not putting in enough time. I don't know what enough time is, but I know I'm not putting enough in with your concealed carry piece. Are you putting in enough time where you're just working on drawing, getting a good sight picture, and firing? And when you do, because it's very in vogue still to sit there in front of a camera and draw from concealment, maybe speed up your rep, but, you know, just a little bit with the camera, and, you know, you go ahead and just break that shot and everything, right? Are you getting good sight picture? Do you have a good grip? Are you validating this training out on the range so that when you go to repeat this skill, when you go to draw, when you go to shoot, are you going to hit what you're aiming for? Can you, like, I think the phrase that John used in our discussion here was, can you call your shot? Can you? And it's a yes or no. It's not, well, you know, I'm working. Cause again, I've people in the image of my brain, you know, like I've guys I'm thinking of when I'm saying this will have a ton of excuses. Well, you know, I'm working on it, man. Oh, well, you know, I just, you know, my blood sugar is really low today, so like I can't really do this way. Or, oh, hey, I'm just getting used to this wider grip on this 2011 because I used to carry a Glock 48. Or, hey, man, I'm not used to a 365, so I'm still working on it, brother. And it's like, no, it's a yes or no question. Either you can or you can't. And that's an inconvenient truth, right, for people in these situations and those scenarios. But when we evaluate, being able to take action, use the tools at your disposal, which is to some degree completely up to you. Either you're going to carry when you leave the house or you're not. And yeah, you know, there's, hey, I can't carry at work. And I believe me, I am in the court on that, your court on that stuff. I hate the people that are like, well, free men don't ask permission. Well, homeless dudes don't have a gun to fight with either. So I have to play by the rules to get the paycheck. And I have a certain standard of living that my wife has become rather accustomed to. And I'm going to do what I have to do to provide that. Now, granted, I work from home, so I am afforded some luxuries other people aren't. But I do occasionally travel. I do occasionally go into buildings. And guess what? I ain't packing. You know why? Because it's against company policy and I like money. Right. So there's still something to be said for what can you do? What can you improvise into a weapon? Do you understand those things? And I think about this stuff every time I go into do one of our active shooter training modules on the computer. And I think it's terrible. And corporate America embraces this shit, you know, completely and totally, the run, hide, fight mentality. And there is some credence to it. There is. But if it's an active shooter situation, people are going to go hide in certain places and you don't know how to secure a door properly. You don't know what actual cover looks like. Is it cover or is it concealment? And there is a difference. And what are the benefits, pros and cons to each of them? And is it worth it? You know, hey, what are the hard cover points in the building? Well, in a lot of, you know, office buildings, it's probably your stairwells because they have to be, or your, you know, because they're attached to your elevators usually, and they have to be for fire code. They're made out of cinder block. Cinder block would, in my mind, given all of your options, be the closest thing to cover you have available. Because conference rooms, if they're not made of some kind of like plexiglass or safety glass, sliding doors and windows and stuff, it's very, very thin sheetrock. You can hear through those damn walls. Like, I spent many years working in office buildings, so I know that's concealment. That is not covered. And some of those, you know, credenzas and file cabinets, that's thin sheet metal. It's not going to stop anything. Again, that's cover. Or sorry, that's concealment rather, that's not cover. So understanding those things. So we kind of, you know, this discussion that we got into here, I personally think pulls in a lot of things. And we talked about the importance of athleticism, health, right? Which is something that I'm constantly pursuing and working at myself, getting stronger, building your body, your gun muscles, right, so that you can go shoot and be better at it, things like that. Things I've pulled from like Bully over at Almost Covert. John and I actually, after we got done with the discussion here, had a great conversation on some cardio tips and things like that that are going to help. And I mean, I think there's a balance point for everything, and we talked about that, but to fool yourself into thinking that you have everything sorted and figured out because you're really good and dedicated to one discipline, one part of your skill set, that's no good, guys. But at any rate, I do hope you guys enjoyed the conversation. I was happy to be able to sit down with John, catch up with him. We actually didn't talk about cars at all, I think, other than that, just that little mention of the Autorama in there. And if you guys don't follow John on Instagram, you definitely should. He has a very, very nice Chevelle. Again, I'm not a Chevy guy. Well, I mean, just because I'm talking about it, I will tell you, if I could have my druthers, man, I'm a huge Mopar dude. Classic Dodge is my jam. So, like, a 68 Charger would be my dream car, but also there's several iterations of the Barracuda that I would really, really love. A Duster, even. I would take a Chevelle or a Nova, you know, just, and if you guys aren't car dudes, you totally should be, man. Like, come on. It's classic muscle cars are awesome. And here's the thing about classic vehicles in general is there's a lot less electronics, hardly any, in those vehicles. So knowing how to work on those, maintain and repair those vehicles, older trucks, even, you know, we're talking like up through the 90s to some degree, right? Knowing how to work on those will do a lot for you in a preparedness and survival situation. Today, you basically need a laptop to do half of the work on most modern vehicles because there's so many electronics and things built into it, and control units that are plugged into everything. It's a totally different discussion. So it's kind of the beauty and the simplicity, especially when you look at the raw power and performance behind some of those muscle cars. Like, and I'm not even talking about the ones that you see on like that Street Outlaws TV show and everything. I'm talking about like just actual factory performance Mopar power, 426 Hemi, right? The 427, I think, was the one that was in the Corvette, right? Just all kinds of stuff, 440 six-pack, right? Just motors that just put out raw power, and they came from the factory that way. But as with all things, liability ruined it, and we can't have nice shit anymore. Unless you go, you know, spend stupid money leasing a Charger Hellcat and, you know, doing donuts with it in the middle of the Lodge Freeway. And if you guys don't know, you can go look that up. That was a big thing during COVID here in Detroit. People would take their COVID checks, their stimulus monies, and they would go put a big downstroke on a Charger Hellcat, and then people would go do donuts in the middle of the freeway because it's a big open roadway with not a lot of traffic on it because we were all forced to stay home. But I digress, guys. I do hope that you enjoyed this week's discussion. I do hope you got a lot out of it. If you got something of value out of this, please consider hitting the subscribe button if you're not already subscribed, and share this with your friends, you guys. Again, the more we grow, the more we can do, the better off we'll be with what we can bring to the table in terms of getting guests, expanding scope, doing more here, both with the visual content on like the YouTube and the Instagrams, and then also here on the podcast, right? But that's all I got for you guys this week. Thank you so much for tuning in. As always, stay safe out there. And until next time, like we always say, work hard, train smarter, and be prepared.